with me throughout the morning, Hannah Stewart, a counter-terrorism expert from the Policy Exchange, centre-right think tank. Hunt, morning.
Morning.
How many of these people are actually radicalised online? What role does that play in the process? Because I know the Conservative Party's thrust this morning will be clamping down on and pointing the finger at the internet giants.
Well, in this case, certainly these three perpetrators, we don't know the details yet, but more generally in terrorism cases in the UK, we've certainly seen an increasing role of the internet as a site of radicalisation, as well as the means in which people would stay in touch with one another and actually operationally
plan. But how much is it a driver of radicalisation, and how much is it somewhere that those who have been radicalised go to have their views vindicated and affirmed?
It's hugely significant, and it's growing. In terms of terrorism cases over the last 20 years, in the last few years, more than half the internet, both judges or prosecutors, cited the internet as a specific site of radicalisation.
A spark of radicalisation, though, or a site of radicalisation where the radicalised go to see their views and to have their views confirmed.
Both. So right. It was where people would be looking for information, looking for material, particularly by preachers that would confirm the views that they were on the path to developing. And then it's almost like an echo chamber.
A self-fulfilling process.
And people would be searching not just for Islamic State material, but for Al-Qaeda material. Often people would search for suicide videos of people who'd previously committed attacks in the UK as inspiration. A lot of people would search and watch for violent beheading videos.
Because I only say that because Professor Peter Newman, an expert in radicalisation and terrorism, I don't know, you probably know him on the circuit, he said few people are radicalised exclusively online, blaming social media platforms politically convenient but intellectually lazy. I mean, it is a hugely complicated thing, this, isn't it?
Yes, and I think the key word there is exclusively, because, you know, a radicalisation, if it were just down to one thing and happened in one place, it'd be much easier to solve. It's a series of processes. It happens for some people both online and offline. There's usually always friendship and family connections. There's often preachers, meetings in community centres, mosques, universities. There's any number of places. It isn't just about online. Physical spaces are also hugely significant in radicalisation. Connections, as I say, with organisations, friends, family. It's a complex network.
And what is the definition of a radical preacher who may well influence somebody in this way? Because Stephen there mentioned Musa Gibril, who's readily available on YouTube, as are others. But there's a spectrum here, isn't there?
Yeah, and so Musa Gibril, I think, is one of the... He typifies, I think, what we're really struggling with as a society, because he is very influential. He's been identified as such, particularly in inspiring people over the last 3 or 4 years to have travelled to Iraq and Syria to join Islamic State. But he's not like Abu Hamza of old. He's not sort of waving a hook hand and shouting for violent jihad at all times. He's much more nuanced, much more careful. He doesn't explicitly call for jihad, but he's spoken about the conflict in Syria in very emotive terms and justified the sorts of acts that might happen there. And that's where we're at that fine line between promoting hate and glorifying violence and terrorism, and it's very difficult to know exactly in those cases whether you can prosecute someone or not, whether you can take that material down.
And there are many who arguably push people into a position that they can be pushed into a position that they can be radicalised. That's what I mean by the spectrum. There are many preachers there who are saying things that we would find uncomfortable, but it would be very difficult to actually legislate against what they're saying. Well, yeah. One, because of freedom of speech, and two, because it is an interpretation of Islam.
Yes, and it's also, we have to remember scientifically the difference between correlation and causality. So we in terms of people in this country who've been radicalised, there's almost always they're found in possession of extremist material or they've been searching for this stuff online. Is this the only thing that's causing them to do what they do? It's something that it's almost impossible to ask. We know we definitely need to do more to stop it, but it's very difficult to know whether we can actually legislate against these people.
And what have we done so far to legislate against these people? Because there have been a series of efforts to do just that. And a lot of people will be scratching their head and saying, well, Theresa May yesterday and saying enough is enough. And people were saying, well, what now?
Do you mean in terms of
actual legislation, TPIMs, you know, these orders and so forth? Or do they need to be strengthened? Do we need to, have some sort of weakening of civil liberty. I mean, where do we go from this? Because there's quite a lot of legislation in place at the moment, isn't there?
Yes, there is. In terms of if you're trying to shut down spaces for extremists to operate in the real world, there's a lot of legislation and regulation that can that we can use to prevent this. I'm thinking things like the Discrimination Act, policies that universities, for example, or community centres have in place, to anti-harassment policies. These can all be used to limit extremist preachers physically using those spaces to radicalise or recruit. Online, I think, is probably the most challenging area, and actually where I think we may see new legislation or certainly new regulation. The Conservative Manifesto called for a new regulatory body. I think
well, they've had a lot of time to do this, you know, which is something we'll put to Karen Bradley from the Conservatives. But just so far, but just very briefly, if these people were known to the police, there are suggestions they may well have been. Similarly, the attacker in Manchester, what are the implications of that? Are the implications of we need more policing, we need more police, we need the intelligence services, need more resources? Just finally, a thought on that, because that's going to be something we need to focus on.
I think the key thing there is about prioritising. So most people, actually, it's about three quarters of people are known to the authorities prior to their involvement in terrorism. And it's when that information goes to the authorities, whether it's the police, whether it's the security services, it's what they do with that information, how they prioritise it, who they, for example, would put onto 24-hour surveillance, who they might just use a listening device for, who they would refer to the government counter-radicalisation programme, because there's a spectrum of responses and there's also a spectrum of severity. And I think the key questions that will be raised following this and Manchester is, are we accurately identifying where somebody is on that spectrum?
Okay, thank you very much. Hannah Stewart with me all morning from the Policy Exchange.